why you should be a socialist. Let's get down to business. So tonight we have three awesome socialists to tell you the case for why you two should be an organized socialist today. They are Sadia Schneider, Jerome Small and Annika DeManuel, all of them veteran socialists right here in Melbourne. We're going to kick it off with Sadia right now. Please make her welcome.
Oh, I can't see anyone. All right. Can we get the lights on the crowd or something? No? Okay, all right. Fine. That's all right. I'll just imagine you all. That's better. Yeah, thank you. Well, I love it that we started with that video. I think it shows Socialist Alternative doing what we fucking do best. Marching, protesting, causing havoc for the people above us. So let's just give him... And so on that note, I actually want to start with a chant. And I hope people will agree with me that there is nothing better than a powerful, irreverent chant. But there's also nothing worse than a woeful one. So for this, I need every single person to stand the fuck up. Now, people have been with us for a couple of months now. You might know that we've been protesting outside the Park Hotel where refugees have been locked up. And I think this is one of the chants that I think always just electrifies the crowd, and I absolutely love it. So help me out. When refugees are under attack, what do we do? When refugees are under attack, what do we do? When workers are under attack, what do we do? When Muslims are under attack, what do we do? When trans rights are under attack, what do we do? Woo! Now, I've been a socialist for about over 10 years now, and I've been chanting this chant for over 10 years, and I've chanted it for like trade unionists, for trans rights, for women's rights, for workers' rights, for Muslims. And I have to say, I will never get sick of this chant. It is my absolute favorite. It owns my heart. Because I think there's just something, it really gets to the heart of, I guess, for me, what it means to be a socialist. That every single fucking time that someone is under attack somewhere in the world, we stand up and we fight back. But I think there is also, that's empowering and that's important. And, I hope that gives you a sense of what that looks like. But I think it can also be really confronting because the list of capitalism's crimes seems endless. Someone is under attack somewhere, literally all the fucking time. And I think, you're probably here because you have some sense of this. You have some sense of the crimes of capitalism. But I think to be a socialist is about really looking that reality in the face. It's sobering and humbling, I think, to realize that, some of the real facts of the world, you might have come to your first protest for refugees because you realized that 11 people were locked up at the Park Hotel, denied their freedom, absolutely atrocious. And then you start talking to people and you realize there's actually 80 million refugees in the world, 80 million people who are displaced, that in the next 30 years, we're looking at 1.2 billion more refugees just due to climate change alone. Climate change, we're talking about an existential threat here, an existential threat that means the Paris Accords, they're a charade, an absolute charade. These targets, they're an absolute sideshow. If people went to the session on a hothouse earth, even if we absolutely eliminated emissions today, we're basically locking in a 1.5 degree warming. It's going to, the trigger points, the destroying of entire ecosystems, the turning of the world into a place where 3 billion people live in an environment that's like the Sahara Desert. And then there's the pandemic. Obviously, there's a sigh of relief around the world that there is a vaccine that could save millions of lives. The people who can afford it first, of course, capitalism. But also, if you went to Rob Wallace's session, it's this is the first of many pandemics. Pandemics are actually inevitable under capitalism because of the production techniques of agriculture and so on. And so I think it can be difficult to really comprehend and really like take in all that suffering and all that misery and the potential misery. But I think being a socialist is about not just not looking away, but about looking directly at what we're up against without illusion and without qualification. It's about realizing that things are not getting better, they are getting worse. And to just let that sink in a little bit, they're getting worse. That number of refugees that I talked about, that is 1.1% of the population at the moment. And that is a new record, actually. That's the most number of displaced people we've ever had in the world at any point in history. And, you know, we live in an era of records. Worst bushfires ever, worst floods ever, worst natural disasters ever. This is the barbarism that we live in, that, you know, the firsts that we're seeing are firsts of, like, absolute catastrophe. But luckily, I think, you know, that's not the full story. I think, you know, there's something really powerful at the heart of socialist politics, and that is the simple and powerful idea that another world is possible. And I think we see that possibility every single time workers and the oppressed rebel, every single time they rise up. You know, they find confidence, they find bravery, they find creativity, and it comes to the fore every single time. And I just I always find myself questioning, where does this come from with you know, the wreckage of society that is, you know, where does this come from? And I think it comes from a place that has been repressed for a long time, and it's because it's so repressed that it's so explosive and so inspiring. And I wanted to talk about a couple of those examples. So in Myanmar, this is Ma Kyu Sin. She's a 19-year-old. She has been going on to the protests. She broke a pipeline, a water pipeline, so that protesters who had been tear gassed could wash their eyes. For this, she was shot in the head and killed, along with 38 other people on that day of protest. And she actually went to that protest knowing that she was probably going to die. Speaking of bravery, she posted on her Facebook her blood type so that her organs could be donated to someone who needed them. The next day, tens of thousands of people marched in response to these killings, and they marched, "We are not afraid." We see that potential and that bravery in the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, who would have thought America, of all places, everyone was ready to write off that place after Trump got elected. You know, and the people who are like some of the most oppressed and most exploited and most downtrodden, people used to being beaten and murdered and hunted by the police, living in fear, find the courage to burn down police stations, to topple statues, sparking a movement that involves millions of people, a movement that, like, nothing that's ever been seen before in history. You know, we think of our time as somehow different from these highlights of the past, but the biggest mass movement that has ever occurred in American history occurred in the last 12 months, and I think we've got to let that fact sink in. Yeah, so I think from the Paris Commune, you know, people went to that session, so inspiring to today. There's no doubt, I think, that our side is fit to rule and their side is not. It's incredible that in all that misery and devastation and all those facts of just how, you know, shit the world is, there is the seeds of something really beautiful. And I think that is the essence of Marxism, that no matter how brutal what is, there is also within that the potential for what could be or should be. And being a socialist, I think, is to look to also see that beauty and to really take that in and to really let, you know, that potential, you know, to absorb it. And I think that's something it's easier said than done, precisely because the world is such a miserable place. And there's this anecdote that I really like. I hope people can follow this, but after the revolution, after October, after workers take power, Lenin is talking to Lunacharsky, and Lunacharsky is the commissar for art. and he's invited to a classical music concert. And you know, Lennon says he loves classical music, but actually he can't go. He can't listen to classical music. And the reason is that it's so beautiful, and with so much misery in the world, it's actually unbearable to listen to that and to really appreciate it. And I guess I like that example because, one, it's a really humanist and beautiful depiction of Lennon and the kind of person he is. And we didn't get to have a session on Lennon, but I hope people, you know, got some of that out of the Russia session. But also I feel like it's relatable, and the way it resonates with me is just in terms of, like, you know, you hear about these highlights, you hear about these moments of human flourishing, and it can be really hard to, like, believe it. It feels like some alternate reality, some fairyland that's totally disconnected from our own, precisely because the world just grinds us down so much. And I guess, you know, I joined in 2008, but it wasn't until I'd been a member for a few years that I think I really got this beauty and this potential. It basically took a mass movement, and my involvement in a mass movement to convince me of this. And I think everyone has this moment, you know, at a protest or at a movement, or, you know, you read about something where it just all, it hits you, like it's real, the penny drops. And for me, it was this thing. So I was after I'd been a member for a few years, and I moved to Spain in 2011, just to sort of be a tourist and, you know, travel, whatever. And when I got there, you know, like the political climate was very similar to Australia. It was like pretty apolitical. The rallies were small, which I went to. I talked to a couple of scattered socialists around the place. You know, and like I'd sort of almost forgotten about politics. And then this happened. This was the Occupy movement. I know a lot of people in this room are young, but this was in 2011. It was a response to years of grueling austerity, that people thought no one cared, no one responded to. You know, there's this real sense of, like, you know, that things are fucked, but God, no one cares. Like, no one even wants to come to a protest. But it was inspired by the Arab Spring, by the toppling of the dictator Mubarak, and it took off in Tahrir Square, and it took off in Spain, in cities across the country, and then inspired Greece, it inspired New York, it inspired Australia, and from one week to the next, the country was just absolutely transformed. And this is me, just to show, it's a really crap photo, holding a banner. You can't tell it, but I'm actually really excited. I think I'm trying to follow the, like, speeches, which are in Spanish. My Spanish was pretty good, but I was trying to pay attention. So we'll move on. There's a better photo. And you know, you can't, the scale of these protests, like they covered, this was in Puerta del Sol, which is in Madrid, and they went down every single street for tens of thousands of people. Like, it just felt, you know, it was one of those protests where the, like, you look at the, there's police there, and the looks on their faces were just like, nobody asked me anything, don't do anything, just pretend everything is fine, you know, because, like, yeah, they're just shit scared, and just impotent. It was absolutely, it was amazing. And, you know, it was just the 20% of the population actually participated in this movement over the next 12 months. It was 8 million people, you know, that ended up coming on the street, and it was such a diverse movement. There was, like, you know, the young people and kids and elderly people and middle-aged, like, public servant types. It was just everyone. Everyone was out on the street. And, you know, there was political graffiti just covered every single, part of the city. You know, every cafe, every bar, every university lecture was turned into a parliament. The politicization just creeped into every part of society. It was like, before, it was like politics was just this thing in my head, and now it was happening in front of me, and these people lived and breathed politics. You know, and there was these mass meetings on, like, political questions. Like, there was a blockade I went to of the Parliament House when they were meeting to pass austerity measures, and the blockade, it tried to stop the politicians from coming in. They actually had to be helicoptered in, which is an awesome sight. Like, this is the vestige of democracy, and these politicians are coming in on helicopters. It was also the first time I broke through a police line, like with a protest that was big enough to break a police line. It was absolutely amazing. But anyway, this protest went on for a while and it turned into a mass meeting of 15,000 people on Marxist economics, which was great. Anyway, so, you know, I just think, you know, this was a really transformative moment for me. And it's like everything I'd heard about for years just was unfolding in front of my eyes, that radicalization, it can come out of nowhere. Like, no one thought this was going to happen. No one. I was talking to socialists, but I was there months before, and it was just, there's no sign of it. You know, the struggle is transformative, and you know, we think of struggle transforming other people, but we don't realize that like we're also going to be transformed by that struggle, and we're going to learn things from it. And you know, that it unleashes society's creativity. You know, it's solidarity. Everything that's good in society just was in the streets, was in the squares, and writing for Red Flag at the time, you know, writing articles, there's all these lines just full of hope and optimism, that this movement is just unstoppable. You know, this is a revolution. There's energy and creativity. It's just limitless. And, you know, the radicalization, it's getting deeper. Now we're having we're stopping housing evictions because people were getting kicked out of their houses. We'd literally blockade them, so they couldn't get kicked out. And I think on the streets with hundreds of thousands of people for months on end, you know, I just felt like I'd never been so sure of why I had become a socialist. You know, it's something that I think I didn't really get until that moment. It really, taught me a lot. So I think to revel in these high points, and, you know, this conference is about celebrating those, and that, you know, I think that's really, really important. But it's also not enough. This movement that I was part of, it wasn't unstoppable. This energy wasn't limitless. And that the radicalization, it did deepen, but it also ebbed. And I learned in probably the most confronting and heartbreaking way, another thing that I'd heard again and again while being in Socialist Alternative and kind of like, oh, yeah, I get it, you know, that the importance of politics and organization. And there was just so many debates in this movement, you know, every night, like hundreds of thousands of people in the square debating, like, should we make decisions by consensus? You know, how practical is that? What does democracy look like? The trade unions, you know, they're tied to the ruling party. Are they our enemies or are they our foes? You know, what's more important? Should we be protecting the tents in the squares or should we be joining the local picket line, you know, the strikes that are happening? And the really frustrating thing is I had all these answers and I had all these opinions about everything that was happening because I'd been a socialist for a few years and I'd go to these rallies and kind of talk to the people, like the three or four people around me, and make the arguments. They'd be like, yeah, totally. And I'd just stand there. Cool. Okay. And then these rallies of hundreds of thousands would disintegrate into rallies of like 100 or 200, you know, and that was sort of it. Because the politics of the movement, the politics that dominated, these politics of liberalism and anarchism, it just offered no way forward. It offered no way to win. And I think watching the movement decline and get funneled into a parliamentary project, that was really rough. And I think even rougher, I guess, was no way to intervene and no way to argue. And especially because I'd been in Australia, I'm used to going to rallies with like a paper and you have a caucus and you intervene and you've got your arguments and you go to the front, you know, just none of that. So this is Iglesias, the leader of Podemos, which is the product of this mass movement. This actually horizontalist, anarchist, anti-political, actually turned into a parliamentary project. Surprise! And he's shaking hands with the leader of the PSOE, which is the Reformist Party in Spain. And they're in government now together. And they actually just, I saw like 2 weeks ago, they just passed $11 billion of bailouts for business. So, you know, and this is a point we've made throughout the conference. Every single movement, it gives rise to these debates and political questions across continents, you know, across continents and time. It's amazing that these same questions come up, the role of the state and elections. What does democracy look like? You know, if people went to Sandra's session, I was reading for that about the Paris Commune and the debate in the Commune, and there was like the liberals who argued we should make the Commune constitutional and we should make it legitimate and we need to not break the laws so that we're respectable. And then there was the like Proudhonist anarchists who were like reject all authority, reject taking power, reject any sort of state form. You know, that was the debate in Spain. Like, it was literally, it was like, started out with the kind of like horizontalist rejecting hierarchy stuff, and it entered in parliamentarism and legalism. So it's like, it's been 100 years since the Paris Commune. Why is this still happening? You know, the same question. Like, you know, we should have this shit figured out by now. So I guess, you know, just to start to conclude, on a more sober note, I think we have to acknowledge that these highlights and these high points of human flourishing that, you know, I think we've celebrated these conference, they are worth celebrating. We need to, like, not just, like, witness them, but we really need to, like, let them in. You know, that is rejuvenating. There is something replenishing about really letting them, like, open your heart to them, to not be totally cheesy. But I think we also need to acknowledge that we haven't won yet. And I think, you know, one of the things we try to emphasize is that, and that I learned, you know, as being part of this movement, and the thing that made me, like, after this movement, come back to Australia, or was originally planning to gallivant around Europe for a few more years, but I came back to Australia because I realized that, like, socialist politics really matters when people, masses of people, move into struggle, because they find, you know, they find within themselves, they find this bravery and this creativity and this kindness that just seems to come from nowhere. But they don't automatically abandon all the ideas of capitalism, all the common sense that, you know, they've had for years and years of their lives. And it's, you know, it's these moments where, you know, and I learned this from the few people I talked to in my, like, circle at these protests. You know, Matt, people can be won to radical ideas, you know, both to take the movement forward, but also, you know, the kind of, like, more radical stuff of, like, what kind of society do we need, and what would real democracy look like, and who should be in charge? And I think those politics are really important, you know, at those times when people are really asking those questions of what next. And I think that politics, you know, it's not enough just to be an individual, like, talking to the three people around you. You need to be an organization, and you need to be able to intervene, and you need to be able to make an argument, and you need to have the resources to make yourself heard, and you need countless people who can make those arguments, make them convincingly, and win people to them. So to sum up, I think being a socialist is about, it's about making a commitment that every single time, whatever the political situation, when someone is under attack, we stand up and we fight the fuck back. And the image that really comes to me from this, I don't know if people went to Mike's session, the LGSM session, but, you know, he talked about, like, there's a person in a picket line and the police pulled him over to the other side and he was, like, scared because the police were going to beat him up. And then all his hands and feet and bodies came out and they pulled him back to the side of the picket line. They saved him. And, you know, being the person who stands up and fights back is about being one of those people, being one of the people that, like, stands with the oppressed and with workers and pulls them back, you know, when they're under attack. But I think it, you know, it's about standing up and fighting back, but I think it also matters how we fight back. It's about having a strategy beyond the next campaign and the one after that. And it's about having a politics that champions not just possibility, but the absolute necessity of human liberation. Because, you know, and I think I want to end with, I guess, the words of our comrades in Myanmar that say it so powerfully and so beautifully, that our revolution must win.
Sadia, and let that be a lesson to all of you to never go to Europe. I'm kidding, but not really. Okay, so the next speaker we have tonight is a man who needs very little introduction. It is the one and only Jerome Small. Please give it up.
We make our own history, but we do not make it as we please. We do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. Now, I love this quote from Marx, and I love the book that it's part of. Life would be a whole lot simpler, though, if it was a shorter quote. Just those first five or six words, we make our own history, full stop. Like that'd be it. That would be it, because as someone that has spent, you know, basically my adult life in the struggle and in the socialist movement, I don't know about you, but for me, making history is the most addictive thing that there is. It is the greatest feeling on earth to be even a tiny part of a tiny bit of history, of changing the world with the people around you. There is nothing like it. And I've had an extremely fortunate life in the struggle. Even in Australia, even growing up in Canberra, for that matter, even in a period of social quiet, you know, the downturn and all the rest of it, you know, you stick around and you stick at it and, like, you end up being part of a bunch of things. And sometimes it doesn't feel that glamorous at the time. Sometimes it feels like a goddamn hard slog, or sometimes it just feels very normal and suburban, and you look back on it. A lot of people here would know, like, you know, one of my first political experiences was sitting outside the South African embassy of the racist apartheid regime in Canberra. And at that time, the Builders Labourers Federation was the biggest union in town. They were building an enormous bloody waste of money called New Parliament House. And they sort of dominated the local Trades and Labour Council. There'd been a state of emergency declared in South Africa. They were black South African working class was organised on the move. The regime was just in catastrophe mode, declared a state of emergency, started shooting people, and the Trades and Labour Council called a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week continuous picket on the South African embassy. And my role in this was not a very glamorous one. My role in this was like spending a little bit of time in a folding chair on a, you know, bit of road, and you know, there's a couple of other people there, and some plumber or delivery driver would sort of rock up and you'd say, oh, sorry, mate, Trades and Labour Council picket line. And they go, oh, sweet. Okay. And drive off. And, like, you know, I'm just like, okay, this is normal. This is how it happens. And then the Builders Labourers Federation, because there was this enormous, you know, building site just up the road, New Parliament House, just sort of happened to grab, like, actually a really massive portable shed off that site, drive it down to the vacant land opposite the South African embassy, plonk it there. Well, I sort of ended up getting bogged, and so I had to call another crane in, you know, from the site. And, you know, anyway, got it set up, got it wired, got it painted, and that was the South African Liberation Centre, you know, putting out information about the liberation movements in South Africa to counter the racist lies. And this is just what the working class did in suburban Canberra in the 1980s. You know, you didn't really think much of it. So sometimes, yeah, so, you know, sometimes, okay. So, yeah, I got to be part of, you know, a world-changing movement. I got to hang out with the Builders Labourers Federation. It's not enough, though. I got to be part of the blockade at the S11 outside Crown Casino. You know, the most powerful people in the world rocked up to Melbourne, to Crown Casino, to have a meeting, and we had so many tens of thousands of people around it, they couldn't even get into their own damn building. Like, they're the most powerful people on earth, but hang on, we're more powerful than them? Like, that sort of experience stays with you. I was very fortunate to be there. Very fortunate to be there when Richard Court, unlamented late, I don't know if this is still around, but previous Premier of West Australia, son of the late unlamented Sir Charles Court, vicious racist, introduced this thing called mandatory detention. Oh, sorry, no, what's it called? It's three strikes and you're out, basically. Three property crimes, and no matter how trivial the crime, the third one, you must go to jail. So people were going to jail for, like, absolute bullshit. Aboriginal people, of course. Richard Court being the sort of guy that he is, you know, like everyone else is, like, you know, trying to get a helicopter into Crown Casino, or trying to get a boat under the bridges, or, you know, just having the day off and, you know, doing whatever they do. Richard Court, no, drive up, drive on. And he drives into the crowd and people are like, it's Richard Court. Hey, 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 it's Richard Court. And before you know it, thousands of people surrounding this racist prick, and one of the few Aboriginal people there, finds Richard Court, gets up on the car. How's it feel, Richard? Got a mandatory detention. Like, and that, I mean, that actually produced a, it was a small, but it was a very real radicalisation. You can understand why, because, like, just that sense of power. We get so little of it in this world, just an afternoon of it, let alone a few days of it. It's enough to keep you going, but it's not enough. I was there in 1998 down in the docks. You know, people say, oh, look, don't worry, I'll be there when the barricades. 1998 in Melbourne, there was actually barricades in the streets down at the Melbourne docks when John Howard was trying to wipe out the Maritime Union of Australia. It's sort of like, you know, normal suburban operation, a whole bunch of railway sleepers, a whole bunch of metal workers, you know, grab the railway, and not sleepers, the actual rails, and build these complicated sort of structures so that they couldn't get a truck through. It's like, oh, there's barricades in the streets of Melbourne, and
people from all walks of life there. One particular night, particularly memorable, where the cops come in and, you know, the call's going out over the radio, the phone trees are going or whatever, and, you know, everyone's piling down there, there's thousands of protesters and just row after row after row after row of police. Like, I'm pretty tall and it was as far as I could see. And so we're standing there all night and we're singing, chanting, you know, helicopters overhead and all the rest of it. And around dawn, John Cummins from the CFMU gets up and says, oh, by the way, every unionised construction site in the city of Melbourne will be starting in half an hour. There'll be no work today. Every single worker will be marched down here. And before you know it, like in about half an hour, you see behind the rows of cops a row of construction workers, hard hats on, and then another row, and then another row, and then another row. It's one thing to, like, it's one thing to read, you know, that the working class united can never be defeated. It's quite another thing to actually see it and realise, like, yeah, we are the most powerful thing on earth, just to get a taste of it. The chant we had then, since we're doing chants, the chant we had then, with thousands of construction workers, wharfies, NTU people, you name it, the chant we had then was, one struggle, one fight, workers of the world unite. One struggle, one fight. One struggle, one fight. One struggle, one fight. Yeah, incredible, incredible experience. I've had a very fortunate life to be making history. But it's not enough. And it's not enough because of the other damn part of that damn quote. We don't just make it as we please, apparently. We make it under, not under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. Now, you don't want to let the circumstances sort of totally overwhelm you. Just say, oh, circumstances, that's it, you know, can't do anything. On this stage last night, people played a song about the first communists that I've ever heard of. In 1649, in the English Revolution, there were communists who, you know, stood up for communal ownership of the means of production. In that case, the land, got brutally slaughtered for it. Shit, they didn't even have a working class going for them, you know? You don't reach back in history and say, oh, look, really, you know, the utopian, you know? They built something, they had a bloody go, they're part of our tradition. So, you know, there's something to be said for fighting no matter what the odds. There's something to be said for organising no matter what the odds. But the circumstances, in that sense, have changed in our favour. We have a working class. Actually, a huge one. Actually, one much bigger than the one that Karl Marx was writing about, a majority class. And not only that, in the working class, we have a class whose conditions of life and especially whose conditions of struggle point in the direction of workers' power, point in the direction of communism. And that was a big part of what Karl Marx had to say. You know, he used to make fun of, philosophers who believe that the riddles to all existing questions lie in their top drawer and the stupid world has only to open its mouth for the roast pigeons of pure knowledge to fly in. Like, what a nice turn of phrase, old Carl. We don't go much in for roast pigeons, you know? But we do see there is, like, you know, Marxism is not just the revolutionary socialism is not just a nice idea that he sort of dreamed up of. It's a bit of this, a bit of that, whatever. You know, let's try this out. It actually corresponds with something in the world. And the thing that it corresponds to in the world is the role of the working class, the strength of the working class, and the dynamic of the working class in struggle. And if you've been to any of the sessions this weekend, you'd know about that. You'd know about it from the Paris Commune. You'd know about it from what's happening today in Myanmar, you know, like in a struggle for democracy, but just the actions that people have been compelled to take in that struggle, the heroism they're exhibiting, the unity that they're building, the organisations that they're forming, point in the direction of a different society. So, okay, we've got that going for us. But those damn pre-existing social conditions and circumstances transmitted from the past. And one of those circumstances, of course, is that the revolutionary left is really small. And we can thank the Stalinist regimes and their, you know, obscenities in the name of socialism for that. We can thank the reformist forces for that. We can thank, you know, many mistakes that the revolutionary movement has made, but it's a fact. And the reformist forces are still really large. We don't have to contend with the Stalinists anymore, except a few, you know, teenagers, whatever, you know. But You know, it's a bit different from when I first started doing stalls, and it was get back to Russia, and there actually was a place called Russia that you could hide, you know, like, anyway. So that's, you know, one huge roadblock to human liberation swept into the dustbin of history by the revolutions of 1989. We don't have to deal with that. Our circumstances have improved to that extent. But we've still got a huge amount of work to do to build revolutionary forces, to build the forces that know the logic, that can draw the logic out of working class struggle, present it back to the working class as a guide for action, and get that action happening. So if we want to build forces for revolution, you've got to be careful what foundations you're building on. And again, if you've been to the sessions, of course you've been to the sessions on 18, you know what the foundations are that we're building on. We're building on the foundations of 1848, the foundations of Paris Commune, the foundations of 1917, the foundations of, you know, lesbians and gays support the miners, the foundations of, you know, the core text, right? You know the tradition that we stand in, where, you know, working class power, socialism is not some place in a map, you know. Socialism right now is where working class people start asserting themselves collectively, forming their own organisations and imposing our will on the world. That's where socialism is. That's the tradition that we stand on. And the more we study that tradition, the more we argue about that tradition, the more we learn from that tradition, the more we, you know, become the embodiments, the living, breathing, fighting, organising embodiments and continuators of that tradition, to that extent, we're so much better equipped to change the world. Because it's a whole lot more fun, and you can make a whole lot more history, if you've got bigger revolutionary forces. I've spent 8 or 9 years now, I think coming up to 9 years as industrial organiser, since I started as industrial organiser. I wanted to share maybe just a couple of stories from that time. And to me, it's an indicator that Marxism is not just a nice idea. If it was just a nice idea, then it could have some effect sometimes and whatever. No, because Marxism corresponds to something real in the world to do with working class struggle, because of that, it's a very effective guide to action, which means even a tiny amount of it applied at the right place, you know, and with the right strategy, and while things are moving our way, can have an incredible impact. And, you know, I could spend a whole lot of time talking about the strikes, which, you know, what is it, five years coming up, the strikes or just passed, you know, the Wildcat strike that a couple of our members led at the Melbourne Liquor Distribution Centre out in the West, Repeat Act, you know, another strike. Thousands of people got better conditions, better pay, are walking around with their heads up right now in more secure jobs because of the industrial action that we organised. There's a long list of stories, you know, from the 20-minute, half-hour stop work for the right to read in a Melbourne call centre. Get that phone call. It's like, hang on, excuse me? We're going on strike for what? Yeah. Like, okay, there's an enormous amount, and they won it. Yeah, it's an incredible thing. So, but one story, I guess, maybe to elaborate on, because I didn't get to tell it last night in the Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners session, the same-sex marriage. Like, revolutionary politics doesn't just matter because we want to get to a revolution. We want to upend this whole obscenity that rules over us. It matters in the here and now. So when the referendum was called for same-sex marriage, the response from the Labor Party and the trade union bureaucracy was just, look, we've sort of got it in the bag. Just don't frighten the horses. You know, let's just do a bit of stuff on social media. So you go to the union's Facebook pages. It's all yes, 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 you know, equal marriage, whatever. There's nothing happening on the job. There's nothing being rolled out through the shop stewards. Our approach, of course, radical politics at the means of production. That's what we're all about. You know, the tradition that we build on, that's, you know, that's what we carry into every room. That's what we carry into every struggle. So, of course, there starts to be a rash of photographs appearing on different union Facebook pages, which is our members and their co-workers all holding up signs saying, yes, you know, we support equal marriage and so on. So this is all very nice. You know, we like to play a role. There's a friend of mine, Richard Mann, who, you know, has been to a few Marxism, a few events or whatever. He recently retired as a crane driver. And so I called him up and said, okay, what do you reckon about getting a LGBTI rights flag, a vote yes flag flying from your crane? If you've been around Melbourne, you'll see all of the, you know, union flags. Let's get a lesbian and gay flag flying. And he says, he thinks about it for about a second and a half and says, yeah, I think so. He talks to his deputy shop steward the next day. This is a long story, but cut it short. He talks to his deputy shop steward the next day. The deputy shop steward, his name is Spike, He says, look, Richard, I wouldn't mind it, but I don't think guys around here would be really into it, you know. Just thought, oh, it's not what the answer I was looking for, whatever. He chats about it with his workmates, and one of them sort of whispers to him and says, look, Spike's son is gay and he's a bit sensitive about it, so, you know, maybe it's that. Richard's like, oh, okay, whatever. A couple of weeks later, the actual shop steward comes back and Richard raises it with him, and his actual shop steward says, yeah, I think it's about time. And so, long story to get the flag up there, but up the flag goes, you know, it's a whole, you know, week or so flying above one of the major construction sites, you know, nice rainbow flag, vote yes, you know, we are union, rainbow flag. Enormously controversial on the site, a lot of guys love it, some guys hate it, the boss especially just hates it, you know, oh, I'm a good union company, I pay the right rates, why do you humiliate me like this? You know, it's just, oh, God. And then he gets his grubs talking on the side of blah, 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 whatever. So after a week, you know, we don't, what is it, the circumstances handed down to us? Yeah, the circumstances dictated that the, whatever, that the flag came down. The shop steward did wear it around like a cape, walking around the construction site for a day. And then it gets to the, would have been 2 or 3 weeks later, there's a regular monthly meeting of CFMU shop stewards in Trades Hall. And there's, you know, 300, 400 mainly guys there. And there's a couple of the, you know, sort of guys. That's like, oh, what are we flying this flag for? It doesn't have anything to do with the union. And one of them says, look, there's not even any such thing as homophobia anymore. There used to be. We used to go out gay bashing. You know, that doesn't happen anymore. Remember Spike from the start of this story? He's in that meeting. Step forward, Spike. And he says, I have never been so angry in a CFMEU meeting. My son is gay, and for you to come out with that homophobic shit and say there's no such thing as homophobia, I am just filled with rage. I can't believe that you're even in this meeting, all the rest of it. The entire room erupts in support of Spike. The guys going, what's this about? They're just like, no, sort of red, looking for somewhere to hide. So, okay, small story. But, like, yeah, when you just know automatically the thing that you want to do is roll out radical politics at the point of production, give it a go and start an argument, that's where you end up when you're prepared to take a risk. That's where you end up. If you're an organised socialist and have the connections, have the even a tiny few forces to push it, that's where you can end up. So, small story. Okay. There's a bunch of other stories. The NTU last year, you know, like people should look at the recording of the excellent session today. Like, we've done a lot to be proud of in the unions, our members, but we, you know, last year we were at the centre of a massive class collaborationist attack on wages and conditions on a major industry. And the formation that we were part of, the formation that we were central to, was absolutely essential to taking bats to that piece of class collaboration and absolutely wrecking it. Like, it's the biggest thing that we've been part of in the trade union movement. We could not have done it without years of patiently building our forces. Because that's one of the circumstances, like, you know, you talk about circumstances handed down. There's a lot of them that we don't control. We don't control whether, you know, there's a mass radicalisation sweeping around the world. We don't control whether there's famine, whether there's war, whether there's economic crisis, whether there's all three or none of them, pandemic. We don't control any of that. We don't control how the working class is being revolutionised and what's being shut down and what's opened up. You know, we can't control any of that, which we could. One thing we can control, one thing you can control, is whether the forces of revolutionary socialism in this country get bigger or not. And I think that's the question that people have to ask. So I guess I'm saying, like, we want you as part of a tradition that extends all the way back to the diggers and beyond, that stretches through 1848 and 1870 and the Cortex strike in 1917 and, you know, flags flying from cranes. We want you to be part of that tradition. We want you to study. We want you to argue. We want you to learn. We want you to, you know, be a living, breathing, fighting, organizing, controversializing part of the revolutionary movement in this country. And one of the things that, you know, talking about things I'm proud of being part of, yeah, I'm being part of being proud of the struggle against apartheid, the BLF, like all of that. One of the things that I think all of the comrades here should be, you know, incredibly proud of, that maybe the thing we should be the most proud of, is this room. This room full of energy, full of fight, full of people seriously engaging with revolutionary politics, knowing that there's, you know, identical rooms, similar rooms in Perth, in Brisbane and Sydney, and that from, you know, like literally a few handfuls of people, we've built an organisation that, you know, we can make a bit of history and we can make so much more. So join us and let's make some history.
That was wonderful. Oh, I want to move back to what Jeremy was talking about the vistas of seeing barricades being built on the streets of Melbourne and hopefully Adelaide and all over Australia in the future. And Annika DeManuel, probably a lot of you are familiar with her and her rabble-rousing on the streets. She is going to talk to us now to close out this panel about what we can do in the here and now, right now, to take the lessons of this conference out into the world, out into our lives, out into the streets, and start to build those barricades. So please make Annika very, very welcome.
Well, it's pretty hard to top those speeches from Jerem and Sadia, but I won't try and top it. I'll just try and match it, hopefully. I think that the world we live in is vile and it's cruel. We've got mass violence rained down upon people who try and resist and fight, or even just innocent victims of war and imperialism, like all across the Middle East, where the United States has been bombing for so long. There's climate destruction, bushfires, floods, the ice caps melting, even the Arctic burning. There's deep racism and there's poverty. This is the world that we live in. And I don't think I need to labour the point, because we have been discussing all of these issues this weekend. And maybe throughout the course of the conference, you've been convinced that capitalism is just, it's no good, not a good system. I'm an anti-capitalist for sure, for sure. You've been convinced to be against the system. But it's not enough to be an anti-capitalist. You need to be an active revolutionary socialist. People go to rallies all the time. We know that because we go to them too, and we'll see hundreds or thousands of people on the streets. And I think it's always a beautiful sight when you're in a crowd of a mass of people or chanting and angry at the state of the world. But it's not enough to just go to these rallies as an individual and bear witness. You have to be part of a group of people, like Sadia said, making an argument about why the world is the way it is and what we can do about it to stop it being so vile and cruel. We need to convince other people that they need to be united with us as active revolutionary socialists. We're fighting for a truly liberated society, a society where people have the right to express themselves in ever what way they want, to do whatever goddamn role in society they want to do. Maybe they want to go down to the river and have a swim after working for a couple hours, not have to, you know, be told what to do by a boss, where they get to make decisions about their own lives and not be forced to actually be part of this system that is destroying the planet and destroying our future. But as active revolutionary socialists, we can't just think about that liberated future only and just wait for that to happen, because we know it's never going to happen unless we fight to make it happen. So that means that we need to fight for things in the here and now. And there is so much that we can do in the here and now. And as a radical revolutionary socialist, you'll be involved in many, many different fights and different campaigns. And I want to run through a few of them, but Jerem and Sadia, they ran through a bit of their life, so maybe I'll tell you a little bit about my political history as well. So my first ever demonstration, I was a couple years old. My mum worked in a women's refuge centre, and she and her workmates organised to get a bus from a shit place in Western Sydney on the rural sort of regional cusp. And they organised a bus for all of the people from the Women's Centre to go to Sydney Harbour Bridge to march to demand a sorry day. And this was a huge march. They took up all of Sydney Harbour Bridge. And so that was my first ever demonstration. And my mum gave to me a sense that you need to fight for a different type of society. And she was recently moving house and we were going through some of our like old stuff, and we found some of my drawings from school when I was a primary school kid. And there's a little drawing that I've done. I don't know what class this was, but I'm just like railing against John Howard. I think it must have been when he supported Bush going to war. I think that matches up with the timeline. So my mum gave to me a sense that you need to fight for a different type of world. And I went to rallies and demonstrations, some with her for refugee rights, some with my friends for marriage equality. But, you know, like I was just one of those guys bearing witness and being angry. And I didn't know about why all these things that I was angry about, why they happened. And all I knew was that you had to go to the demonstration because you were angry and you had to say that. And I went to university and I really hated it. Tony Abbott was trying to deregulate university fees. And there were demonstrations going on and I knew about them. In fact, a member of Socialist Alternative, embarrassing, tried to get me to go along to one of the early education protests, but I was like, no, I've got a class. But then two things happened. One was our Melbourne University Club had a morning caucus and they were talking about the news. They had a political discussion about the news, and then they were like, oh, it's 10-2, we better go do some lecture announcements for the next rally. And one of them walks into the lecture theatre and they're about to go up and ask the lecturer, oh, you know, can I give an announcement about deregulation, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, holy fuck, it's Sophie Mirabella. So Sophie Mirabella is, I don't know if most people here might not know her because she's so terrible and why would you, but she was one of the people who walked out of that Sorry Day speech. That was one after people marched, like me and my mum, demanding that for many years. So Sophie Mirabella, and they fucking get her, man. Like they run and they get megaphones and they're chanting. They get dragged into a cupboard by a security guard. It's like the news of the campus. And of course I heard about it. And I was like, yeah, that's fucking cool. Yeah, yeah. And then there was a really terrible but quite popular TV show. I think it still runs, but it's very irrelevant. Q&A. And our comrades, a few of them in this room, I think, they staged a disruption of Q&A when Christopher Pyne, the education minister, was on it. And they start going and they're chanting and they put the banner down, but the banner's around the wrong way. And this is live television. And I watched with my mum, every Monday night, of course, I watched Q&A and I'm watching this unfold and I'm like, yes, yes, this is so good. I love these guys. And then I had a tutorial. I went to those. I went to the tutorial and everybody was like, everybody was talking about, you know, this event on campus. And there was a young liberal in my class and he was like, this is, you know, this is so disrespectful. Like, you know, they're just like destroying their free speech or something like that. And I was like, no, this is goddamn right. Why should we have to pay $100,000 for our degree? And then I was like, fuck, I didn't go to the demonstration. So I made it my mission that I would definitely go to the next education protest. I managed to bring one person along with me. So the first, you know, one of the first people I brought to a demonstration, where I was a socialist, everybody should do it. And then I get talking to the members of the Melbourne Uni Club and I meet Rob and he sits me down and he's like, do you want to get a newspaper? And I was like, I don't have any cash. We didn't have card readers back then. And then like we're marching through uni house. I don't know how
How long are we going? We're marching through, we're very early on in the political career. We're marching through Union House, and Rob looks at me and he says, well, what do you think we need to do to stop deregulation? And of course, I've been watching Q&A, and there was a nurse on Q&A who was railing against the Liberal government. And one of the things that she mentioned was that we need a strike. In order to, you know, deal with the problems of the Liberal government. And I look at Rob and I say, well, we need to have a general strike, of course. So that's how I became a socialist. The end. <Sorry. laughs> So the education campaign was one of the first things that I was involved in, but from there, there's been so much more. So people have been talking about the refugees who are locked up at the Park Hotel, but of course it began before the Park Hotel. There were 60 men or 60 plus men locked up in the Mantra Hotel on Bell Street. And one of the things that I'm really proud of as a member of Socialist Alternative is that when we found out that these men were going to be moved, and at that point we did not know where they were going to go, within a couple of hours from at 9 o'clock at night, we called hundreds of people to Bell Street in Preston to make sure that we could be there to support those men so that they knew that there were people on the streets who supported them and would be with them. And hundreds of people came and they stayed till 2, 3, 4 a.m. chanting so that the refugees inside would know that we were there supporting them. And the day where the men were moved to the Park Hotel was one of the most emotional demonstrations that I've ever been to, because you saw the full face of the Australian government on display with these men who had done nothing but try and seek asylum, packed onto buses and forced to sit there for hours. And the Victorian police on their horses and in their riot gear there to transport them to who knows where. And these men went past on their buses as we tried to stop them from leaving, smiling at us and waving at us because they knew that we were there with them too. And in that refugee campaign, actually, it was really important that there were, and today still, it's still going on. In that campaign, it is important that there are socialists involved, because some people say that the way to fight for these men is to be polite, to not cause too much drama, because, you know, they just have to plead with the government to be free. But the government is never going to free them because of the kindness of their own hearts. They will free them because we've built a movement that is powerful enough to put a crisis at the heart of the system that they can no longer ignore for those men to be really and truly free. Another campaign that we've been part of is the climate movement. On the Marxism website, I'm called the convener of Uni Students for Climate Justice. It's an elected role. One of the things that we organised was the bushfire demonstrations in the 2019-2020 summer period, where just thousands, tens of thousands of hectares were burnt, smoke was choking the cities, billions of animals died. And we said, this is not a natural disaster. There's nothing natural about this at all. This has been caused by a system that's run on the basis of profit and competition. And so that means that we need to have a political response to that. And so we organised protests in all the major cities. And in Melbourne, we were faced with criticism from Daniel Andrews and the Victorian police and the ABC, and what's that one with that idiot talk show host, Talkback Radio? Anyways. But also the BBC, would you believe it? And they said that we're wasting resources. What a fucking joke. Like, wasting resources? This whole goddamn system is wasting resources. Millions of people die every year because they've got no access to food, because they're homeless. We build bombs That's wasting resources. And so we said, well, no, we won't not have our demonstration. We're going to go ahead with it. And in the pouring rain, 30,000 people marched through the streets of Melbourne. The other campaign that I was involved in was the campaign, and it still exists, you can join it, the campaign against racism and fascism. And one of the things that we had to confront was a growing far-right force on the streets of Melbourne, Reclaim Australia, the True Blue Crew. They were organising demonstrations on the streets of Melbourne, and we kicked into gear and said, we have to confront these people in the streets. We organised mass demonstrations. We went to Bendigo, we went to Melton. And we built a movement that was so strong and so terrifying to these little freaks. But we humiliated them. They got too scared to hold demonstrations because they knew there'd be like hundreds of people to meet them. And now all they can do is lift weights in gyms in the southeast suburbs. So you should be involved in pushing fascists off the streets. You can be involved in fighting for a climate movement that can truly confront the climate crisis that faces us. You can be involved in fighting for refugees and asylum seekers, or stopping the government from passing bills to raise the price of education so that working class people can no longer attend it. You can also be involved in arguments and debates and fights, and a lot of them happen on the university campuses, where we have to face up to the future Bill Shortens and Anthony Albanese, who say, oh, well, we shouldn't have a protest. Instead, we should go lobby Pauline Hanson. And you can say, well, that's a really dumb idea. And debate with them and argue against them. Because I think what we really need is we need to rebuild the activism and the radicalism of the university campuses. In the past, university students have been integral to fighting against South African apartheid, to fighting against the Vietnam War, to winning our marriage equality. We need university students all across Australia to join our clubs on all the different campuses so that we can fight the future Bill Shortens, but so that we can have these mass campaigns that can draw other people in, because students in the past have been sparks for revolutions, revolts, and uprisings. Okay, so I'll start to wind up now. People often say to me, like, after demonstrations that I've chaired, like, wow, that was so amazing, like, it was really inspiring. And the thing that I always say to them, anyone can do it. Literally any of you people could do it. But what you need to do is you need to join a group of people who have the experience in organising protests and giving a speech to thousands of people. They can give you help to write your speech. They'll teach you the chants that you need to know to get the crowd going. Anyone can do it if you're part of a group of active revolutionary socialists. And we need smart Marxists too. We're not just yelling in the streets. We're not just, you know, like we actually have an argument about the way that the world is and what we need to do about it. And Sadia talked about, like, when it clicked for her. I haven't been involved in a mass uprising, like mass movement like Sadia has, but one of the times where it really clicked for me about what I was part of was in a cafe that doesn't exist anymore near Trades Hall. I was doing a reading group with Costa about Revolutionary Rehearsals, a book that you can buy in the bookshop. And with Costa, we discussed some of the really important points about revolutions. And there's two important lessons that come out of that book, and they're repeated in the chapter time and time and time again. You need a revolutionary party to push forward the movement, and you need to be organised before the revolution happens. And that is the key lesson. That is the key thing you have to draw out of this conference. We can't wait for the barricades, like Jerem said. We need to be learning, educating, getting used to being in campaigns, fighting our enemies, because when that movement does come, and that movement will come because the crisis of capitalism roll on and on and on, and it will hit Australia. And when it does, we need thousands, tens of thousands of people who are active, revolutionary socialists to bring this system to the ground. And because Sadia and Jerem got to do a chant, I'm going to do a chant too. All right, it starts out slow and then we'll get fast, okay? So it goes, I believe that we will win. 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 I believe that we will win.
Back up here, because the only reason I have is to say give it up once again for our awesome panel, which you're already doing.